Good morning and welcome. We're pleased to have everyone here this morning for the our presentation of the International Energy Agency's medium-term oil market report. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm co-director and senior fellow at the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And we're really pleased to have with us today Antoine Haff, who is the head of the oil markets, oil industry and markets division within the International Energy Agency. He also is the chief editor of the monthly oil market report, which I'm sure a lot of you read on a monthly, if not a little less frequently than that, basis. And we're really pleased to have Antoine here. We were supposed to, as many of you might recall, have had Antoine here a couple of weeks back, but we had another visitor in the form of Sandy. And so that was a little disrupted. And so we're really glad that we were able to reschedule this event for today and glad that many of you could be here despite the holiday week. Because, you know, one of the things we were sort of just talking about before coming up here is just, you know, the amazing amount of changes that have been going on within sort of the global energy landscape, oil markets in particular, and what a job it is to sort of keep track of those things, not only on a sort of a day-to-day or month-to-month basis, but then to be able to compile an outlook that sort of, you know, continually informs the debate and helps how people are thinking about the policy issues and the market issues surrounding some of these, you know, major changes that we're going through, whether it's through oil supply disruptions or new supplies coming on market, or sort of age-old issues about the role of markets and speculators in price formulation and those sorts of things, how valuable it is to have documents like this one that try and put together a picture of what things will look like over the medium term and explore some of these substantive issues in that context and shed some light on all of our thinking. So with that introduction, I think it'll be a great morning discussion, and invite Antoine, who is, you know, no stranger to D.C. He was previously the chief market analyst at the Energy Information Administration, has had a long career in energy analytics, oil analytics, and a number of leading consulting firms and publications, and is remains engaged in a wide variety of research these days. So, Antoine, if you give a presentation, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. Thanks for inviting me, re-inviting me. And thanks for coming on the holiday week. I just wanted to share with you some of the conclusions of the report, the midterm report, which is a five-year outlook. And it's kind of a new product comparatively within the menu of IEA publications. The IEA has long published, since the 1980s, a monthly report. Then it published an annual World Energy Outlook report, which looks at the long term, 20, 30 years down the road. This is kind of an intermediate product that tries to bridge the difference between the short term and the midterm. Of course, since 2 weeks ago when I was scheduled to speak here, the WEO did come out and made the headlines with the forecast that the U.S. would be the largest producer as of 2017. And coincidentally, 2017 is, of course, the end term of the period that we consider in this midterm report. So I assume that some of you may be interested in discussing that. It's actually a forecast that's based on numbers that we have supplied to the WEO. We do a lot of work supporting the WEO, even though it's not always fully acknowledged formally in the WEO. But we haven't really articulated this conclusion that the U.S. would be number one, and we would put it slightly differently, and maybe I'll come back to that a little bit later. But to start with the conclusions of our report, basically this is the first report that came out, the first midterm report in almost a year and a half. The previous one was June of 2011, and then there was an update in December of 2011. And since that time, things have really completely changed. It's a completely different picture, a completely different narrative. Back in 2011, the theme was still rising prices and, you know, supply scarcity and runaway demand growth from China and other non-OECD countries. Now we have basically a picture of a much more comfortable market, almost a throwback to the period before to the 1990s, to the period before the run-up in prices, 2002, 2008. much more comfortable supply, much more robust supply growth, especially from North America, much more subdued or somewhat more subdued demand growth. So much more comfortable balances, a smaller call on OPEC over the forecast period, a call on OPEC that's actually below current levels of OPEC production, and a return to spare capacity levels within OPEC that we haven't seen since about 2003, and that used to be associated with much lower prices. Now, we don't forecast prices, but we don't necessarily think that returning to previously very comfortable levels of OPEC spare capacity will mean a return to lower prices. So that being said, this return to more comfortable market conditions takes place in the context of a much more risky environment. It's always been a tradition to say that there's a lot of risk and uncertainty in the market, and it tends to be irritating when it seems to be a way of hedging one's forecast and covering one's bases. But in this case, there's a really an increase in the reality of risk. Risk is not just an abstract threat hanging over the market. In the last year, we've seen repeated disruptions, both driven by political factors, as in Yemen or the Sudan or Syria, or by resource issues, unplanned turnarounds that lasted much longer than expected, as in the North Sea, or hurricanes, as in the Gulf of Mexico. So the level of disruption last year was really unprecedented. In the third quarter, it averaged about 1.3 million barrels per day. And the reality of geopolitical risk in the Middle East is no longer just an abstract threat. It's a reality that has an impact on the market. And that's the context, I think, in which we have to see this return to more comfortable levels of spare capacity and balances. And finally, one of the main takeaways, I'm starting with the end, but one of the main conclusions of our findings of our report is that even though on balance headline figures suggest something that's more benign, in fact, if we look at the geographical distribution of supply growth and demand growth, there's tremendous challenges because the supply growth is not happening in the right place and not in the right type of crudes. Supply is growing in markets where demand is contracting, and supply is not growing where demand is still rising at a very fast pace. So there's a complete revolution in the trade map. We actually think that crude, the level of crude trade will drop significantly over the next 5 years, and will drop more in certain regions than others. It will certainly drop more, in our view, in North America and the Americas in general. It will increase in Asia. Exports will decrease from some regions like the Middle East, where more crude will be refined domestically to meet demand or to feed refining capacity, which is on the rise. So a very changed map of trade, but also, conversely, an increase in product trade. And that's also a big change from previous models. It used to be that refineries were located next to the markets, and the crude trade was a global trade. The product trade was more of a regional or local trade. That's changing, and we see product trade being now conducted on a global basis, and product being shipped from far-flung places like China all the way to here, the U.S. or Brazil, and so on. So I'll just walk you briefly through some of the more detailed slides. In terms of the economic forecast, it's kind of a top-down approach. It's based on the geopolitical, on the macroeconomic assumption, which is a bit more subdued than before. So we expect global demand to grow by 1.1 million barrels per day, which is a bit less than we had expected in the previous forecast a couple of years ago. But this is also growth that takes place from a lower base, because 2012 has been a much weaker year for demand than had been forecast. So the combination of a very low starting point in 2012 or 2011 or so, and more subdued pace of growth basically drops the aggregate, the absolute level of demand by about 500,000 barrels per day compared to what we had anticipated a year and a half ago. So it's quite significant. The report came out just at the same time as the IMF World Economic Outlook of October came out. But we had anticipated some reductions in the IMF forecast. So we actually assume in our forecast the exact growth rates that the IMF came up with in its latest world economic outlook. The growth in demand, as before, is very contrasted geographically. On the one hand, OECD countries, mature economies, see continued contraction in demand. Non-OECD countries continue to lead demand, to account for all of demand growth, actually, and more. So there's a drop in contraction in the OECD, continued growth in non-OECD. But one of the differences is that China actually is growing at a much slower pace than we had previously anticipated. So even though the non-OECD continues to lead, the role of China within the non-OECD countries has decreased significantly from previous forecasts. We now see a much more subdued pace of growth, not insignificant, but more reasonable, more moderate, pretty much in line with what we've seen this year. So higher than this year, where this year we expect, it looks like Japanese demand growth have been stronger than Chinese demand growth. We don't see that continuing in the next few years, but we see a more subdued pace of Chinese demand growth than in the last 10 years. In terms of breaking down demand by product, there's also very strong contrast. And even though the pace of aggregate demand growth looks okay at 1.1%, when you look at the middle of the barrel, middle distillates, gas oil, diesel, it's a much stronger pace of growth, which continues to be a challenge in terms of supplying the market. So a very strong pace of distillate demand growth, 1.7% on average over the forecast period, driven in part by the many users of distillates. Unlike other products, distillates can be used for space heating, for transportation, for industrial uses. So it's really driven by many aspects of the economy. And that's in terms of volume growth, it's going to be the leading component of the increase in consumption. LPG growth is also forecast to be quite significant, helped in the U.S. in particular by the development of the gas industry and the liquids associated with tight oil developments and shale gas. So we see that as supporting a kind of petrochemical renaissance, but also continued growth in non-OECD countries like Asia and the Middle East, where some of the producers, particularly Saudi Arabia, are trying to capture more of the value chain and build up downstream capacity. So petrochemicals do support demand, NAFTA and LPG. LPG mostly in North America, where that tends to displace actually NAFTA for petrochemical users, and NAFTA still in countries like China, LPG in places like Saudi Arabia. We see this growth in North America, Asia, the Middle East as being a challenge for the petrochemical industry in Europe, as it's been the last 20 years. We see that continuing, and more consolidation, more contraction in European capacity, for instance. Gasoline continues to be the largest component of a very large piece of the market, 25% of the market. But the share of gasoline gasoline share of the demand barrel is forecast to erode, continue to erode. Most of the growth, again, is taking place in non-OECD countries, driven by the increase in the car ownership rate. Jet fuel is growing at a slow pace, partly thanks to efficiency improvements, partly because of the revisions with the economic forecast. And so in terms of China, we see now Chinese demand growth of about 3.4% per year, with stronger growth in gasoline and much stronger growth in NAFTA, driven by the car ownership rate and by the continued development of the petrochemical industry. So why China is slowing down a bit, other countries continue very strong or even grow stronger, and we see a very strong growth in India, very strong growth in Middle East countries. Africa is having a bit of a takeoff in demand growth, and countries of the former Soviet Union here are forecast to be to show quite significant growth in demand, which is a bit kind of an extrapolation from the patterns observed this year, where after many years of very weak, very tepid demand growth in Russia, for instance, we've seen a bit of a takeoff. So that's the expectation here is that this is just the beginning of a trend, and we're going to continue to see significant growth in Russian consumption as income levels increased there. Now, in terms of supply, it's a different type of forecast because it's much more of a bottom-up approach. It's much more based on projects on the, that we've kind of surveyed and tallied together, more than on a price assumption, which is, tends to be kind of the approach of the wheel. But we see here a very robust pace of supply growth, stronger supply growth than demand growth, with remarkable rebound in non-OPEC growth of about 4.8 million barrels per day on aggregate over the forecast period. What's remarkable in this evolution is that, in contrast with the last 10 or 20 years, the growth in supply is driven no longer by the FSU, but by North America. So here we color-coded the regions where supply growth is coming from. And the red bars of the years from 1998 to 2008 represent Russian and FSU supply growth, and they really dominate the picture for those years. But looking now at the 2010s, we see almost all of the growth coming from the Americas, from the US, from Canada, from Latin America as well, and we don't see any contribution from the FSU in aggregate. We see some years of small growth, some years of decline, but basically not much of a contribution in total. So here we break it down by country a little bit more, a bit differently. So really the US leads the increase for the next 5 years with a growth of 3.3 million barrels per day. Canada is second, Brazil is next. And that really dominates the picture. In contrast, we see declines in Europe, declines in the Middle East. Mexico edges down further, but that's not enough to change the big picture in the Americas. So a very, very lopsided type of growth with everything concentrated in the Western Hemisphere and very little, if any, elsewhere. Part of this growth is, of course, coming from non-conventional plays, which we think are economical at prices that we've seen and that we expect to continue, that we assume will continue to be experienced over the next 5 years. We do not have a price forecast. Our price is an input in the model, and we basically use the futures curve at the time of finalizing the data, which is perhaps not the only way of doing this, perhaps not the best way, but that's the way we've picked so far. We might revisit that in future. But the assumption is the futures curve, which basically translated into a price declining to the 90s by the end of the forecast period. We might actually see lower prices than that, which would, of course, undermine the economics of some of the non-conventional developments. U.S. tight oil is a big driver. About 3 million barrels per day, more than 3 million barrels per day of aggregate growth over the period, 2.5 including condensate, some more in NGLs. So that's really a big change, and we try to break it down by play. Now, here, of course, I have to include a caveat that we haven't really produced our own forecast from scratch of non-conventional growth in the U.S. We don't have the resources to do it. What we've done is that we've surveyed forecasts made by others, and we've tried to compile them, criticize them, put adjustment factors here and there, and that's basically our best guess. But we don't have access, we don't have the financial resources, data resources, to produce our own bottom-up forecast of non-conventional growth. Maybe that will come, but this is not what this is. So that's a significant caveat to the forecast. In terms of the forecast, even though it's very aggressive, it's not as aggressive as other forecasts that are out there, both in the case of the U.S. and in the case of Canada. We, for example, think that the very strong pace of non-conventional growth, LTO, in the U.S. is not necessarily sustainable at recent levels, for a variety of reasons. We also feel that logistical constraints will slow down developments in Canada somewhat. Without logistical constraints, development would be higher in Canada than we currently forecast. So we factor in some bottlenecks, some constraints, some slowdowns in terms of access to market, which will delay development of some projects, in our view. Technology is really the name of the game. It's really the new technologies have been a game changer. That's really something that we had not anticipated a couple of years ago when the last forecast came out. This is very true of North America. There's really a transformative impact of new technologies that had been underestimated and that we're trying to now account for. Technology is also a factor in developing or maintaining production in mature players in the North Sea, in Russia. So we see some kind of stabilization of the pace of contraction in the North Sea, but still declines 200 KBD in the UK sector, a bit more in the Norwegian sector. In Russia, we don't see much growth in aggregate. We feel that the recent strong growth shown this year from some greenfields project would not be replicated in the next 5 years. And brownfields, we see that as being also not very dynamic. Contributions for deepwater is not insignificant, but it's not the major piece. Most of it in Nigeria and Angola, some in Brazil. Biofuels, here we expect we grow by 2.4 million barrels per day over the five-year period. That may be a bit aggressive, a bit optimistic, but that's our forecast based on largely on projects that we have surveyed. But we do see some pressures on U.S. consumption, U.S. production, and pressures in Brazil as well. In terms of OPEC, we see increases in OPEC capacity, and here just as in non-OPEC, the leader is North America. Within OPEC, we see Iraq as being the major contribution. Of course, recent performance by Saudi Arabia has been very strong. Saudi production volumes have been at levels unseen in about 30 years. But most of the growth over the next few years in capacity is expected to come from a single country, Iraq. And in our forecast, we also include a very strong growth in Libya. That's partly misleading because that's partly based on a very low baseline in 2011 when production in Libya was reduced because of the civil war there. So on paper, we have a very strong growth in OPEC crude capacity over the next 5 years. But if we take out Libya, it's a much more average growth. What's significant there is that so much of it is driven by Iraq. There's also some growth in the UAE, some growth in Angola, some growth in Nigeria. Now, another caveat to our forecast, we assume in the forecast that current sanctions on Iran will remain in place for the next 5 years. They've been disruptive. Iran exports have been very low, at very low levels. That has had an impact on production. We assume in our forecast that sanctions will remain in place, that compliance with sanctions will remain comparable to what has been recently. And as a result, we are anticipating a reduction, long-term reduction, in Iranian production capacity. Now, that's just an assumption because we, of course, can't predict what will happen with Iran. And in fact, it's probably an unlikely assumption because it seems difficult to conceive that sanctions will remain in place for 5 years without anything giving. But that's the best assumption we can use, short of forecasting compliance with international demands on nuclear industry or military confrontation. So that's our working assumption. But it's not a prediction, and that's something that I think we have to make clear. What we're trying to do is to forecast whatever we can forecast, to investigate whatever can be known about the market, and basically to forecast the context in which developments elsewhere, like Iran, are likely to take place. But we can't really forecast the developments in Iran itself. The result of our production forecast and our demand forecast is that we return, as I mentioned before, to a much more comfortable level of spare capacity. The colon OPEC that we anticipate remains below 31 million barrels per day for most of the forecast period. It just rises above 31 at the very end of the forecast period in 2017. So it's a call on OPEC that's essentially lower than recent production levels within OPEC, so it's easily met. And the implied spare capacity in OPEC rebounds from somewhere around lower than, in terms of effective spare capacity, lower than 3 million barrels per day last year to around 6 million in 2015, 2016, goes down a bit at the very end, 2017. But those are levels of spare capacity that we basically haven't seen since 2003. We saw them briefly back in 2008, 2009, when the economic crisis caused a collapse in demand, but there was a fairly short-term dip. We haven't seen those levels being sustained for quite a while. We haven't seen them since the price rally of 2003 to 2008. So returning to those levels would be returning to levels consistent with prices under $40 a barrel. We're not forecasting that, partly because we're not forecasting prices, but also because it's clear that this return to more comfortable capacity will take place in a higher risk environment with geopolitical concerns in the Middle East, with instability in many Middle East regimes. So I think it's possible to conceive of an environment in which we have both spare capacity and relatively high prices. Just like during the rally between 2003 and 2008, we saw prices rise and the levels of OECD commercial inventories rise as well, which in previous periods would have been seen as contradictory. But because of the perception of tight supply capacity at the time and very strong demand growth, there was a very strong market appetite for storage, a very strong demand for storage, and that allowed the price to go up in conjunction with inventory levels. I think in the next few years, we could see the price remain supported despite an increase in the level of OPEC capacity. So Iraq production, the WEO, actually here we borrowed heavily from the WEO research. The World Energy Outlook does include this year a very meaty component looking at the outlook for Iraq. And we have incorporated part of that forecast into our midterm forecast. And that translates into an increase in production capacity of nearly 2 million barrels per day in Iraq itself. Iraq is already the second largest OPEC exporter, but its importance in the market is expected to continue to grow at a fast pace. This assumes no major crisis between the KRG and Baghdad. I think the underlying assumption in the WEO is that political disputes between the central government and the Kurdistan regional government would be smoothed over, would be that some form of accommodation would be reached. Iranian capacity we see as collapsing under the sanctions. Again, this is kind of a thought exercise more than a real prediction. What would happen if sanctions remain in place, where capacity would go down because the Iranians would not be able to shut in capacity without causing damage to at least some of the fields. There are some variety of opinion about this. Some analysts feel that at least some fields could actually benefit in Iran from a reduction in production, but we think that on balance it's more likely to be detrimental to long-term production capacity than beneficial, and we do expect a decline in long-term production capacity. In Saudi Arabia, there's only one major project that we see as being incremental to capacity. That's the Manifa offshore field project, which we see as coming on stream around next year, but partly offsetting declines in other fields. So we see capacity being sustained at high levels, but not as much growth there as in Iraq. And in the Emirates, we see capacity as rising by a little bit more than 700,000 barrels per day. largely due to new water and gas injection projects at mature fields, not new fields, but development of enhanced recovery at some of the old fields. Kuwait we see as being on the downtrend, bogged down by political issues, constraints on investment. Qatar, we expect to edge marginally higher until 2014 and then to drift down again to 2017. Libya rebounds, but that rebound is already underway. It's basically a return to pre-existing capacity. Algeria, here we see as going down a bit. Algeria declines by 180,000 barrels per day. Libya increases by 1 million and a quarter from 2011, but those 2011 levels were distorted by the disruptions due to the civil war. Nigeria and Angola contribute. We see continued growth there, 400 KBD in Nigeria, about the same, even more in Angola. And a lot of that towards the end of the forecast period for Nigeria and towards the second half, so to speak, of the forecast period for Angola. So offsetting the trend in elsewhere, like in Saudi. And Venezuela, we see very small increases in capacity, no revolution in capacity, regardless of what happens politically. Under the scenario where the current leadership remained in place, either Chavez or his successors, we don't see much scope for new investment, but we see some increases in some of the new developments, but not much. In the event of a regime change, we do not expect that to translate into any increase in production over the forecast period, because we feel that it would not be opening up for investment, increasing investments from national revenue into PDVSA would not be a priority, would not likely be a priority of any new regime. Any new regime would likely be forced to continue social spending at fairly high levels for a period of time. And any opening, as may occur, would not, in our view, be likely to translate into higher production within the forecast period. Beyond 2017, yes, very significant, very strong growth potential, but not in the five-year outlook. NGLs continue to be a very significant component of growth, and that's something that really is a challenge for the industry because there's a considerable lightening up of the supply mix, both from OPEC countries and from North America. So we do see OPEC NGL, condensate and unconventional production increasing by more than 1 million barrels per day to almost 7 million barrels per day by the end of the forecast period. We reduced the component of that comes from Iran, but we see still strong growth from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, and from other suppliers and UAE particularly. So Saudi Arabia and the UAE are the two major drivers of NGL growth. In Saudi, 265 KBD. In the UAE, more than 1 million, rising to more than 1 million by more than 200. So that's a significant component. So where does that leave the scorecard of the top producers? In our forecast, we see U.S. production rising just past Russian production by 2016 and increasing the delta by 2017. We don't see U.S. production necessarily exceeding Saudi production. In other words, let me rephrase this. In order to forecast that the U.S. will be top in 2017, we have to make assumptions about the level of capacity utilization in Saudi Arabia, which is more difficult to do than to forecast actual production capacity, probably. So we forecast Saudi to continue to be the largest, to hold the largest capacity among producers. And under certain circumstances, it's conceivable that U.S. production could top, in our view. Saudi production and Russian production. But under other scenarios, we could see higher Saudi utilization of its capacity, which would translate into higher production potentially than the U.S. The point is that the message that U.S. is number one is a very powerful message, which remains at the core, I think, of our forecast in terms of highlighting the very, very significant transformational impact of new technologies, of new developments, of so-called unconventional or non-conventional supply in North America. That's really one of the big takeaways of our forecast. So what does it mean for trade? We expect the volume of crude traded internationally, long-haul trade, to drop over the forecast period. Despite the increase in demand, despite the increase in supply, we feel that the volume of crude traded over long distances is going to drop quite significantly by more than 1.5 million barrels per day. And this is due to a combination of factors, again, a more benign, more modest demand forecast than we previously had, much more growth in production in North America, closer to some of the biggest markets, but also a shift in refining and a shift to more refinery capacity growing, being moved closer to the wellhead, in contrast to previous patterns where refineries were close to the market. So we see a significant decline in the volume of trade. This is a map that tries to capture it. Most of the decline is really occurring in the Western Hemisphere. Like volumes of crude imported by the U.S. drop significantly. Crude imported by the U.S. from West Africa is dropping by 1.3 million barrels per day. Volumes of crude imported from the Middle East drop by 1 million. From Latin America, we also see a decline from Latin America to North America of about 300 KBD, so a significant drop. An increase, on the other hand, in volumes imported by Asia. And there we see increases, but some coming from new places. So what's moving from the Middle East, even to Asia, is not necessarily increasing. We see some declines there as well. We see, on the other hand, gains in imports from Russia into the Far East. Generally speaking, here, to summarize some of the figures, Middle East exports dropped by nearly 2 million barrels per day. That's because of the very strong growth in the pace of domestic demand expansions in the Middle East, and the very sharp increases in Middle East refining capacity, which we think will translate into more net exports from the region to other markets. In the OECD, we see imports in aggregate dropping by 4.3 million barrels per day, largely because of demand contraction, because of refinery closures, especially in Europe, and because of more supply coming from the region, especially in North America. North American imports lead that decline, dropping by more than 3 million barrels per day. Non-OECD imports, on the other hand, increase by nearly 3 million barrels per day, but not enough to offset the decrease in OECD. So increases in China of 1 million, or slightly more, and even more than that from other Asian countries. East of Suez, that's where most of the growth takes place. And those supplies will come mostly from Africa. So even as Middle East exports decrease over our forecast period, we see an increase in exports from Africa, from African producers. And most of that increase will be directed, if not all of that increase, will be directed to Asian markets, China and other Asian countries. Levels of exports from the Middle East will continue to be mostly directed to the Asian market, east of Suez, decline to other destinations. So we see a kind of a reinforcement of the trade axis between, on the one hand, Asian consumers, on the other hand, African suppliers, and in the middle, Middle East producers being themselves large consumers in their own right. So there's kind of a bifurcation of the global trade map. On the one hand, a Western hemisphere that's becoming more self-contained. On the other hand, an East of Suez market which draws on the Middle East and on Africa and is directed mostly to Asia and also to the Middle East itself. So Africa really drives the export growth largely to other Asia, declines in North America. And now, in terms of refining capacity, we see also very strong changes, a big reversal of shifts that we have experienced in the last few years, especially since the 2008 financial crisis. So for the first time since then, we see growth in refining capacity running ahead of growth in product demand, more capacity now than is being built than we expect demand to grow by. And a lot of that growth in refining capacity will again take place in specific markets, Asia, particularly China and India, and the Middle East, as well as some increases in North America next to the wellhead. Russian refinery runs have been very strong lately. We expect them to stay fairly robust. Over the last 6 months, we've seen really a renaissance in refining. Very high runs, both from OECD and from non-OECD countries. Record runs in Russia, record runs in Brazil, record runs in China. But we've seen also, surprisingly, very strong levels of refining activity in Europe. And lately, European throughputs have exceeded year earlier levels, even though the level of capacity in Europe has shrunk because of refinery closures over the last few months. So very strong activity there. We don't see the strength in European refining as being sustainable. We see that as being fairly short-term. But the strength in India, China, and in the Middle East refining, I think, is likely to be there for the future. One of the interesting aspects of conclusions of this forecast is that there is a strong likelihood for a gap to emerge in China between the level, the capacity that's being built there, and the actual level of demand growth. There's a strong likelihood that China overshot in its recent capacity expansion programs. They're really building refining capacity at an extremely sustained pace, very high pace, and they might have anticipated, they might have planned their capacity expansions with the assumption of much higher demand growth than they will eventually experience. If that happened, that would make China a significant product exporter. And there's potential for many consumers in many parts of the world to fill up their tanks with made-in-China gasoline in the next 5 years. That would be not necessarily something that would last for decades. It probably would be a fairly short-term development, or mid-term development, until Chinese demand catches up with domestic refining capacity. But there may be a period of years when refining capacity in China really exceeds domestic demand requirements. And we have, in our forecast, we have significantly adjusted downwards the expected increases in refining capacity. Some consultants, for instance, who focus on China, are forecasting much higher capacity growth than we do in our midterm report. We assume that because of the slowdown in Chinese demand growth, some projects, some refining capacity expansion projects will be slowed, will be toned down, will be reduced, will be postponed somewhat. We may be overconfident that this will be the case, because I think the pattern in China tends to be that once a project is approved and signed, it tends to go forward regardless of any change in economic conditions. So we might really see a significant overhang of refining capacity in China, adding to very strong export-driven capacity in India and a growth in capacity that's both targeted at the domestic market and at exports in countries like Saudi Arabia and others in the Middle East. Lately we've seen, on the other hand, closures in more mature markets where refineries tend to be older, smaller, not to enjoy economies of scale, to be somewhat antiquated. So that's happened in Europe in a big way. That's happened partly in the US, some in Japan as well. And we expect that to continue somewhat. That's already translated into much more robust refining economic environment lately than was previously the case. So there's a bit of a rebound, a renaissance there. So by the end of the forecast period, we expect China to account for about more than a third of the expansions. The Middle East, about a quarter. We see some other expansions in Asia, mostly India, but some smaller expansions elsewhere. And Latin America, we put in here for 7% expansion of the aggregate expansions. So as I said, we adjusted those numbers downwards somewhat. We also see very strong growth in upgrading capacity and desulfurizing capacity. So it's not just crude distillation capacity; it's all the way, all across the refining scope of product manufacture. So we see that as outpacing demand, and as a result of this discrepancy between the pace of refinery expansions and demand expansion, we see the level of refinery utilization as going back down again towards the middle and the end of our forecast period. So some pressure on refining margins and some pressure on refining activity. The feedstocks are becoming lighter and sweeter. That's a challenge for many refiners. That's a challenge in the U.S., where most of the economic high-performing refineries are geared to run heavy sour crude, typically traded at discounts to benchmarks. So there's a real challenge there. Much of the new supply in the U.S. is not really suited for being run in the U.S. It's not particularly rich in distillates, which is more where most of the demand growth is also taking place. So that's a problem in the U.S., in Canada. That's a problem with some of the recovery in supply from OPEC, from Libya. Much of that supply, which is coming back to the market, is lighter and sweeter than the market really needs, in contrast with what we had seen previously when disruptions in light sweet supplies were challenged to the market. Now we have the opposite problem of an excess of light sweet supply. We have upgraded our refining modeling capacity. So we have a new modeling system, which we call PSM, which we developed with a consultant. We see a transformation in product markets, global players emerging. So despite all this increase in capacity, still constraints on distillate supply. Even though in aggregate refining capacity is running ahead of demand, that's not really true for distillates. We see some pressures there, and a lot of markets remain short distillates. That's the case most markets except Europe. So pressure and constraints there. Gasol is expected to grow to account for almost half of the supply, the demand growth in the next 5 years. And so yields are moving towards higher production of distillates, but it's very hard for the market to catch up with demand. Gasoline, on the other hand, is increasingly oversupplied, so downward pressures on gasoline prices. European surpluses persist. North American, we see imports, net imports as disappearing, although some gross imports might continue. Asian remains very short NAFTA because of petchem demand. And the Middle East meets demand growth. One challenge is fuel oil. One unexpected challenge is fuel oil, where we see some shortage in the market because of so much capacity being high deep conversion. And we see actually more resilience in resid demand than we expected, partly because of power generation demand in the Middle East. So surprisingly, whereas resid fuel oil used to be a byproduct, an undesirable byproduct of refining production, we find that this is a market that's recently displayed surprising strength, and we're likely to see continued strength in future as Middle East refineries become higher performance, transform, upgrade more of that resid, whereas regional demand for resid continues to be sustained by power generation requirements. So that's basically it. What we see here again is a level of OPEC spare capacity that we hadn't seen since about 2002 or 2000, even before. But again, with behind that kind of aggregate eye-catching figure, we see a lot of pressures, a lot of constraints, a lot of the challenges, tremendous infrastructure requirements, infrastructure building requirements, partly to support the increase in product trade. And we've seen the reality of that just recently on the East Coast with the disruptions caused by Hurricane Sandy. It's really clear that constraints in import capacity are already felt in the market, are biting whenever there's a disruption. Those issues, the requirement for more capacity to import products is going to be a very, very big challenge for the market as the market shifts from a crude trade-based system to a system that's much more focused on the downstream, on long-haul trade of products, and on long-haul movements from refineries closer to the wellhead to ultimate demand markets. Thanks.
Anton, thank you very much for that broad-ranging exploration of your outlook for the next few years. I'd be the first to say what a difference a few years makes. If you would have told us a few years ago we've been sitting here having this conversation, I probably wouldn't have believed you. So I know we've got we're sort of got an embarrassment of riches with all the oil market experts you've got in the crowd, so good luck to you. But to start off, I thought maybe, you know, there's a number of things that you went over in that forecast, which, like any forecast, would keep me awake at night if I was publishing it, basically, saying there's a lot of outlier events that could come in and disrupt this forecast. I, rather than delving into some of the more specific questions at this point, I mean, what are the things in that forecast that for you in particular, give you pause, you know, that you're not sure over the next several years whether or not that's likely to happen, or you're fairly confident? I think Iran was one of the ones you pointed out, but you're fairly confident it won't materialize in that way, but would have sort of a strong role in altering sort of the outlook you've put forward, if you want to share a couple of thoughts on that.
Well, I think one of the wild cards or big unknowns, of course, is the pace of Chinese economic growth.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're kind of in the dark. I mean, we don't have special expertise about Chinese economy. We kind of extrapolate from recent developments, what we've seen in the market, from information intelligence that we receive from market participants in China, in the region. But I don't think there's any transparency about the Chinese economy. There's many questions about the quality of the data, not just all data, which may not be the worst, actually, but other macroeconomic indicators. So it's certainly a big question mark. Mm-hmm. And there could be the performance of the Chinese economy could be actually weaker than we forecast. It could be also a lot stronger. The recent weakness could be very temporary, transitory, and we could return to a much more sustained pace of growth. What's sure, I think, is that if Chinese demand growth rebounds, it's not going to be the same kind of demand growth because the Chinese economy is not going to be the same. Regardless of the pace, there's going to be a shift in the nature and the drivers of the Chinese economy, and that's going to have an impact on the market and the type of oil demand that's implied.
Yeah.
But on the supply side, clearly there's many many questions. So Iran is one of them. Developments in the Middle East. I mean, we kind of did a lot of marketing of our report based on the catchword "a new oil map," and now the press is full of the new Middle East map and the new, you know, Middle East geostrategic balance and so on. Mm-hmm. So how the Syrian conflict will play out could have potentially very significant impacts on the oil market, on supply, on oil transit. This is not something that's easy to forecast, and even if you think you can forecast, it's not necessarily easy to publish a forecast based on that. So that's a big question mark. Those are some of the largest.
Yeah. And one of the other questions I had is thinking about the variety of people that read this outlook. If I was an energy company right now, and particularly an oil company that, you know, maybe is invested in some of what has really gotten people excited, which is some of this unconventional resource space, but maybe also invested in some, you know, high-cost frontier oil in places where, you know, the actual cost of recovery is still yet to be determined and those sorts of things. I look at a world where you're saying with all of the sort of geopolitical uncertainty and market uncertainty in the forecast you just presented and still comfortable prices. There's significant, you know, downside for that in terms of the oil price forecast, and I know that's not what you're doing, but did you all spend some time thinking about how this feeds into a longer-term outlook in terms of what kinds of investments between here and there may or may not be made, or areas where you might see there a risk of production growth not going forward because of the future you've put forward, which is, frankly, the opposite of a scarcity model that, you know, we've been working with for the last several years?
Yeah, somewhat, but I think the risk when you start thinking about a drop in oil prices, what it would do to projects, is that if there's a drop in oil price, probably the cost of production will also drop, right? Because in the last few years, we've seen really the increase in oil prices kind of track the increase in development cost and those and production costs, and those were partly based on metals costs, on the cost of services, labor, and so on. Presumably, in an environment where oil prices would decline, production costs would also see a bit of a drop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And lastly, you know, one of the things that you lastly talked about was this sort of redesign in the global oil trade situation, not only sort of geographically, but also in terms of the type of things that are traded. You know, being more products oriented than oil oriented. I wonder if that has something to do, or if policies at all here in North America feed into that equation. I mean, at the same time, you're talking about how the refinery mixture here is not necessarily slated for some of the products that are coming on board, and so there's sort of the policy question here of oil exports and whether or not that would actually. There's a policy difference, if that would make a difference in sort of some of the decisions for some of the unconventional producers here in the United States, or if that really is, it's more a matter of global refining economics than anything else. I mean, do you think policy decisions like that would have a change, or did it feed into your thinking at all?
So you're talking about an export ban on products?
Yeah, the fact that you have to sort of apply for an application right now to be able to export crude from the United States. Would that would sort of an opening up of that situation do anything to materially change what you're looking at for the U.S. outlook, or is it?
It's a big question. I'm not sure we've really explored it in all its ramifications, but I think we see product exports as being the way in which crude is exported in the U.S. in the absence of a broad permit on crude exports. Mm-hmm. So if it became much easier to export crude, conceivably it would have a bit of a downing impact on our refining forecast for the U.S. It would probably undermine somewhat U.S. product exports. That being said, over the forecast period over the next 5 years, I'm not sure that would really be fed. That probably be something that would filter through beyond the forecast period. If we look at the Western Hemisphere, for instance, where U.S. product exports are directed, largely Mexico, Latin America, Brazil, those are countries where there's also been, I think, policy decisions, or sometimes market decisions, to rely on imports from the U.S. rather than developing domestic capacity. For instance, the Brazilians had extremely ambitious refining capacity expansion projects, and they shelved those because they have competing demand for capital from the development of subsalt. So there's been a conscious decision to push back development of, in the case of Brazil, Brazilian domestic capacity, and rely on imports from the U.S. So that creates, that maintains a baseload of demand for product exports, even in the scenario where it would become more. It would become easier to export crude as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I can see a number of people sort of chomping at the bit to ask a question. We do have some ground rules here. Please identify yourself, wait for a microphone, yourself, your name and your affiliation, and if you could ask the question in the form of a question, that'd be great, but please do wait for the microphone because we are webcasting as well today. Carmen? Oh, right there.
Thank you, Antoine. Thank you very much for excellent report, the first one under your regime. And I think it's been one that's had a good effect on markets. It certainly wasn't your intention, but I think markets have responded to having a lot of their expectations reinforced in terms of calming the market down a bit. I want to go back to Sarah's first question about what you call wild cards. and this will be a little bit long, but please give me a moment. Given that the European Banking Union is probably going to be less than it first appeared without real sufficient regulatory authority to oversee all the European Eurozone banks, without sufficient funds to rescue them under plausible scenarios, with austerity measures increasingly clear that they cause recession without increasing capability to refinance sovereign debt, with the likelihood of labor market and other competitive reforms being very low with falling GDP and rising unemployment, that eventually the only outcome that will be necessary will be devaluation of currency, Eurozone exits, and this could be messy in terms of capital flight. And my question is, if you agree with this kind of negative outlook, number one, and number two, if we do see something like this, do you think it'll be more like 2008, or will the world economy have insulated itself from this so this becomes something that just affects European oil demand?
I think we are seeing already a very big impact of from the European crisis. What we hear from China is stockpiles of coal, of products building up at the ports, and that's, I think, what's translating into much lower levels of diesel demand as there's less coal that needs to be transported. So that's clearly there's a very strong interdependency of economies around the world, and we're really seeing a slowdown in Europe affecting the Chinese market, for instance. So in a doomsday scenario for Europe, things could be worse than 2008. I don't think our European member countries would be very happy if we put forward that type of scenario. But the downside to the forecast, the downside risk is significant, sure.
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. Another European question for you. One of the things people are wondering about with the U.S. export or with the U.S. production boom in oil and also shale gas is whether some of that will head across the Atlantic to the European markets and make Russia, the EU countries in particular, less dependent on Russian energy sources. What are your thoughts on that?
We're not factoring in an increase in crude exports from the U.S. To Europe. That's not what an assumption in our forecast. What we're, I think, more likely to see is an increase in European product imports. We're likely to see European consumption is declining, right? There's a continued contraction in demand. It's actually, European demand is now at the level of 1980s, I think. It's amazing how much contraction has taken place over the last 20 or 30 years. It's never reached the bottom. It keeps going down further. So there's a decline in European consumption, but we're likely to see, I think, even steeper declines in European refining capacity. That's a very politically sensitive issue in Europe today, because it's kind of the pace of refinery failures has increased to a degree that European policymakers are now concerned that they overshot with their environmental policies and policies that, in effect, created a very heavy burden on a European refining industry that was already kind of burdened with old antiquated plants and so on. So, yeah, there might be a bit of an adjustment effort by policymakers to try to keep some of the European refineries on life support. But I think the big picture is that refining capacity will decrease in Europe because it's uneconomical compared to very cutting-edge, economical, extremely competitive plants in Saudi Arabia, in Asia, India, China, and also in the U.S. U.S. refineries are among the most competitive in the world because they benefit from comparatively low prices, especially if they have access to crude priced off WTI. And they also benefit from incredibly low energy prices, very cheap gas. So it's very hard for European refineries to compete with that. So I think it's less likely to see Europe import U.S. crude to burn in their refineries. It's more likely to see European refinery throughputs continue to decline, and Europe rely more on long-haul product imports. And those, some of those could come from the U.S., and I think we'd likely come from the U.S. Others may come from India or may come from the Middle East.
Thank you, Antoine, and thank you, Sarah. I'm Mark Finley with BP. I had a question, actually two questions, on the you showed a slide at the summary of your OPEC section where you first had two lines that said OPEC's implied a capacity and effective capacity, and I don't know what the difference is between those two. And the second, you had something that said the market call on OPEC oil and the adjusted call on OPEC oil, and there were pretty big differences between those two, and I'm just wondering what the difference was in those two categories.
Right.
Thank you.
Implied capacity, I think, is based on the abstract level of capacity. Effective capacity is what is commonly described, referred to as capacity. It's capacity that can be well online within 30 days, sustained for 90 days. I think implied is something that's a bit longer, you know, like a capacity that's been offline in Nigeria and that we know is there, but we don't really know what it's going to take to make it accessible to the market. So effective is smaller. Effective is really what matters. And in terms of adjusted call on OPEC, it's a call on OPEC that is adjusted for inventory changes, historically looking backward.
Can I just follow up on that? I mean, if you could go to the slide, it said with inventory changes, but the difference was like 2 million barrels a day.
Right.
And I can't imagine that inventory changes would be 2 million barrels a day.
Well, it can be. I think my understanding, it basically incorporates some of the miscellaneous balance. And if you look at the miscellaneous balance item, for instance, in the first quarter of this year, it was 1.6 million barrels, I think, and then it went down to 1 million barrels in the second quarter. So you had very significant inventory. This increase in the miscellaneous to balance, which is kind of the adjustment factor between what's left when you look at OECD stocks, global supply, global demand. What doesn't add up is the miscellaneous to balance line item, and that item really exploded, blew out in the first half of this year, to 1.6 in the first quarter, I think 1.1 in the second, and then it contracted again in the third quarter, and it's looking to be quite small in the fourth quarter. So what does account for it in this case? I think most of it represented Chinese strategic stock building, which implied stock building in China was about 600, I think, 1,000 barrels per day on average in the first half. Or even more than that. So there are shifts in inventories that are not captured because we only measure inventory changes in the OECD. So those swings can happen.
Alan Khatib, consultant. Can you comment on the difference in price between the North Sea crude and the Oklahoma crude here? And the fact that, there has been a complete reversal over the last few years, and now the Brent crude is $20 or more than the U.S. Marker crude, and how you see this developing as the production in the United States increases.
High on the agenda, I guess, for the last 6 months or more, and I don't think we have any special insights into this that hasn't been shared by others. I mean, I don't think we have much to add on this that hasn't been already out there. But basically, we see the discrepancy in WTI and Brent prices as a result of rising production in the U.S., in the Midwest, in Canada, landlocked production that has a hard time getting to the market, and that builds up in and around Cushing. conversely, in Europe, we've seen Brent production declining. So there's inverse pressure from the supply side. From the demand side, one of the reasons why the spread between those two benchmarks increased so much just in the last few months, I think, is the strength of European refining margins. There's been very strong European demand from refiners for crude. So Brent is the local supply, the local benchmark, and that's the first one to register this an increase in demand of that nature. In contrast, in the U.S., we've seen declines in demand because of disruptions, because of unplanned outages. So we had the outages caused by Hurricane Isaac back in August and September. Then we had unplanned outages and fires and problems in the West Coast, the Midwest. We had some closures on the East Coast. So even though margins are great for European, for U.S. refiners, the aggregate level of refinery demand for crude in the U.S. has not been as robust as one might have expected because of those problems. And that's put additional pressure on WTI prices. So over the longer term, I think, clearly, if you look at the longer term, you should expect this discrepancy to correct, because there would be a need for new outlets, for new logistical capacity to bring landlocked supply, rising supply to market. I think we are expecting some of that to happen over our forecast period, but not enough to erase the gap, the differential in prices. We see some easing of the differential, but not a complete return to previous patterns.
Building on that, though, staying on the U.S. story for a minute, you mentioned that most of your work on sort of the U.S. side and the U.S. unconventional side was a compilation of forecasts, but not something you were able to do your only work on, your own sort of individual work on. What are the key factors that you would want to explore there that you can't quite get into using everybody else's data and forecasts?
Well, I think, you know, wellhead data, field data, production data, field by field, well by well, I think would be needed. There's also a very short history of light actual development, so we don't really know what the appropriate decline rate should be, and many question marks.
Yeah. Frank, did you have a question? No?
Yeah.
Guy, and then Frank. Frank and then Guy.
We'll let the boss go. And then that's you.
So, Anton, thank you very much. Frank Verastro at CSIS. So I had two questions. They go back partly to Sarah's. So the first is just as you look at forecasts on demand, on the demand side, as the non-OECD becomes a much bigger player, the level of confidence in lack of transparent data, because everyone's forecasts now year to year or every 6 months vacillate wildly based on certain assumptions, right? So when you start talking about comfort levels, you could be in a totally different world really fast. And then just picking up on the U.S. piece, and part of this is from the WEO, there's a projection that U.S. production goes up 3 million barrels a day in the next 5-6 years, but then levels off or comes down. And so part is we don't know what the track record, what the tail looks like, but the recovery rates now are so low that as you learn from the resource, the expectation that that's going to grow is at least out there on the optimistic side, which plays back into the export question of crude versus product, right? So what do you do with it? When do you get a constraint in this market that Canada and U.S. production overwhelms the system and it needs an outlet?
Demand growth. Sure, I mean, it's proverbially difficult to predict, but I guess, as in is generally the case for production, for demand growth, there's kind of three components. You know, one component is GDP growth, income growth, which is probably the largest component. But there's another component, which is demographic growth. And then when you look at non-OECD countries, there's the issue of price, and everywhere. But in non-OECD countries, what's specific about prices is that there's relatively low swings in prices at the consumer level because of subsidization. So, you know, it's difficult to predict what exactly the economy will do in the next 5 years. We could be overshooting. Economic growth could be weaker or stronger. But we know that population growth will continue in some countries. You know, some countries will age. I mean, China is aging, and that's partly why our forecast of Chinese demand growth is more subdued. But other countries are in the midst of very rapid demographic growth. Countries in the Middle East, country India, others, Africa. So that's a significant component of the forecast, I guess. And you know, we have been, I mean, the IEA having kind of a two hats, being a data or research shop, but also policy advice type of a company, has been pushing for desubsidization. However, in the current environment, it's difficult to anticipate, you know, very significant progress in desubsidization over the next 5 years. Looking at what's happening in Jordan, it's not really an encouragement for countries to try to desubsidize prices. So we're not really expecting the Saudis to make any headway increasing gasoline prices or maybe even power prices, even though they're more ambitious there than they have publicly been on the oil side. We're not really expecting, you know, other Middle East countries to desubsidize rapidly. So that's, I think, we're likely to see continued non-market-based, very low prices for products in many non-listed countries, and that, I think, will support demand.
Guy Caruso, CSIS. Antoine, thank you. Excellent. IEA's gain was EIA's loss, but we appreciate everything you're doing there. But a little bit of a follow-up to Mark Finley's. If those numbers, 5 to 6 million barrels a day, effective spare capacity, are perceived as being where we're headed, most of it would probably be in Saudi Arabia. And last time their spare capacity got anywhere near that, they complained to those of us then in the U.S. government that they were spending 50 to 75 cents per barrel per year to maintain that spare, which, based on that, my quick calculation, that's about $1 billion a year. So I think, you know, most likely what scenario would be the Saudis would allow some of that effective spare capacity to diminish and put it in mothballs like they did in the 90s. I mean, I realize you're not, your job isn't to predict Saudi behavior, but it's important. Would you think that's probably a reasonable way we're headed?
So I think the problem with spare capacity is that it's I think historically it's been more accidental than intentional. There's a tendency to, including from the Saudis, to try to put kind of a policy and a voluntarist spin on it. But historically, most of the spare capacity has occurred as an accident. Sure, the Saudis find it comfortable to have some spare capacity in order to calm the market when the market gets tight, prevent prices from increasing too much and threatening long-term market share. I don't think they would deliberately try to curtail capacity based on a weaker demand or market outlook. Partly because this comfortable level of OPEC capacity is partly misleading or an illusion, given that a lot of the risk is also within OPEC. So you know, there's large spare capacity in OPEC, mostly in Saudi, but there's also a very large supply risk in OPEC, mostly in Iran. And I don't think, as long as the situation in Iran doesn't continues to be potentially volatile, I don't think the Saudi, I mean, I don't want to be reading into the political intent of the Saudis, but just looking at the market, I think it would be difficult to imagine that they would deliberately try to curtail capacity, make a calculation of that the cost benefit would really call for shutting in of capacity in this very volatile geopolitical environment.
You know, one final question. You just brought up Iran again, which, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, you can't sort of forecast what's going to happen with their with the embargo and the sanctions and things like that. But one of the things that I was wondering is, you did spend a little bit of time talking about forecasts of what would happen to, you know, their ability to bring production back online, depending on how long, you know, the current situation lasted. do you have a time frame over which that starts to become an issue? Is that an issue now for, you know, folks looking at field development and maintenance within Iran in terms of their ability to bring production back online, or is it sort of a two-year window of sorts, sort of a point of no return, I guess, if you will, not to be overly dramatic?
I don't think we know, honestly. I think we could guess, but this would be really a wild guess. I don't think we have the information to make a very educated guess on this.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say thank you once again for coming and sharing your outlook with us. It was really interesting. We certainly hope you'll come back again and do it in the future. So
thank you.
Time.